Never solve the problem of racism until there is a recognition of the fact that racism still stands at the center of so much of our nation. And we must see racism for what it is. It is the notion that one group has all of the knowledge, all of the insights, all of the purity, all of the work, and all of the dignity. And another group is worthless on a lower level of humanity. And then he says the ultimate logic of racism is genocide. He wasn't quoting anybody. Those are King's words. The ultimate logic of racism is genocide. So what we're battling here is genocide. And I mean in a very physical way. You know, we talk about social death, but there's so many ways that we are being killed, right? And so unless we acknowledge that, we won't acknowledge that we're in a state of emergency.
Welcome to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the nation's capital, produced for WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington. I'm Esther Averam. Well, activists and activism continue to make and shape headlines locally, nationally, and internationally this week. Today we'll speak to one of the organizers who shut down a gathering of the Fraternal Order of the Police in Baltimore, and we'll speak to the convener of the town hall meeting against police murders and mass incarceration happening tomorrow, Saturday, August 20th, here in the nation's capital. Finally, it's the third week of the month, and the second half, historian and author Robin Kelly will join us for this month's episode of The F Word, exploring fascism, neo-fascism, proto-fascism, whatever people are calling it in the United States today. So, as always, we have a jam-packed show for you, starting with our headlines. More incidents of and about police abuse were in the news this week. D.C. police said that they were investigating an incident where an African-American woman was assaulted by a white D.C. police officer who lifted her off her feet, pinned her against a vehicle, and called her a prostitute before releasing her without arrest or charge. The woman reported that she is a school teacher in a video of the incident that went viral on Twitter. In Baltimore, members of Baltimore Block and Black Youth Project 100 blocked the entrance to a convention of the Fraternal Order of Police held inside the Hyatt at the Inner Harbor to call for justice in the death of Corin Gaines, a mother shot to death by Baltimore police, and to protest the way that the FOP defends police who murder civilians. A member of the D.C. chapter of BYP 100 led some chants and specifically addressed police officers minutes before he and other protesters were arrested.
So, a black officer was shot and killed last year in PG County here in Maryland by his off-duty. The very people that he worked with shot and killed him. So remember, black officers, you're black as well. A black officer was also killed in Chicago. So remember, the very entity that you're trying to protect, they're not here for you. The system is racist, it was built on finding slaves. The system is never here for you. You're aiding and hurting your own people. That's
why I cry. Well, actually, joining me in the studio today is Tracy Redd, who you just heard at this week's Action. Welcome to the show, Tracy.
Thank you for having me this morning.
So, tell me, what were you kind of demonstrating for this week at this FOP gathering? What are some of the demands that you read to or attempted to read to the police?
We were gathering at the FOP convened. It was for the state of Maryland. They have 79 lodges in the state of Maryland. And we were, you know, it was a week after I attended the funeral of Corin Gaines, you know, with her family, you know, so that raw emotion was still in me. And so I wanted to make sure I confronted some of the people that were were responsible for her death. And also, our first demand was that they release the names of the officers of the Baltimore County Police that shot her. I went past her house. The police station was directly across the street. They called for a body camera unit, but they canceled it moments before they broke down her door, and she literally lived across the street from the substation in Randall's Town. So I have questions about how they were practicing and why is the FOP protecting these officers' names when they didn't protect Corrin Gaines.
Wow. And so what are some of the demands that you had for this action?
Well, our first demand was that we had the name of the officers released, because last time police officers' names aren't released in these cases, so we don't know who to help hold accountable for this. Other demands that Baltimore Black came up with, that they want all 79 FOP lodges converted and shut down and converted to community centers, homeless shelters, because community centers and homeless shelters are far and between. A lot of community centers in Baltimore was actually shut down and tried to be privatized at one point, right, in recent history. And we want like an oversight of FOP contracts and negotiations. You know, we want police, we want citizen review boards, you know, by elected citizens to have control over the FOP. Because a lot of people don't realize FOP is the most dangerous fraternity in America, and they protect killer cops. Like Darren Wilson, when he shot Mike Brown, before he called 911 or for ambulance, he called his FOP office to find out what he should do, because he knew he will probably get desk duty. So this is what the FOP does, and we want to expose them.
I think that those of us just in the general public want to know kind of more about the FOP. Is the FOP the same as a union, or is it a private organization, like a club, like a fraternity, like it says fraternal order?
Yes.
So it's not the same as the union, right?
It's complicated. They are a union. They have a lobby office here in D.C. I remember, if you remember last month, folks in D.C., myself included, we locked ourselves to the legislation advocacy office at FOP here in D.C., and we occupied the space over 19 and a half hours by chaining ourselves to the building and to ladders as well. So they also operate as fraternity. You know, they have clubhouses where they have, like, vending machines and pool tables and stuff like that. But they also operate by a union that they have, like, union dues, and they lobby for laws like the Blue Lives Matter bill that make police protect a minority. But it's a profession. The FOP lobbies for that in many, many states.
Okay. And so our tax dollars, in a sense, when we pay to fund police, who therefore pay dues into the FOP, that we're basically funding the FOP.
Yes, in a roundabout way, we are funding the killing of Black people in this country.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about the fact that police are actually supposed to protect and serve, mm-hmm. and that they are public employees that we pay,
yes.
This just goes one step further, that then they therefore can form these powerful associations like the FOP to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So what's next? I know that this Stop FOP movement or action is going to continue. How do you see proceeding from here?
Well, I'm an organizer and activist here in the based out of D.C. My brothers and sisters in Baltimore Block, Raleigh and Michaela, you know, are holding it down in D.C. I'm here in Baltimore. So the next day, there's third chapter showing up for racial justice, which is a white ally group had action. Where they were at the Fraternal Order of Police in Baltimore, where all the lodges came together for a party. They stood outside with signs lining up the paths to the door, you know, saying things like defund the police and demilitarize the police as well, you know, because the FOP also argues for a lot of military equipment in some cities as well.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for joining me, getting up early. I hear a little frog in your voice this morning to be with me on the ground. I've been speaking with Tracy Redd, an organizer, activist with BYP 100 here in D.C. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, actually, in Chicago, where BYP 100 is headquartered, the police superintendent has called for the firing of seven officers for their response to the fatal shooting of Laquan McDonald in 2014. Superintendent Eddie Johnson's decision on Thursday, August 18th, comes nearly 2 years after Officer Jason Van Dyke fired 16 shots at Mr. McDonald, a 17-year-old African-American, as McDonald was walking away from police officers. Van Dyke, the only officer who's fired his gun that night, has been charged with murder and is awaiting trial. He's pleaded not guilty and said he feared for his life. More on the movement for Black Lives, including the upcoming town hall on police murder and mass incarceration here in D.C. after headlines. Focusing on Black economic empowerment, dozens of people met last night at the regular meeting at the Black Workers Center here in D.C. Chantel James has more.
On August 18th at the United Black Fund on MLK, the 1DC Black Workers Center held a meeting with community members to discuss the center's mission, which is to create and maintain economic justice through popular education, direct action, and the creation of worker-owned alternatives. At the meeting, community members vetted their concerns about the ability of Black people to find a foothold in the legitimate workplace. Sophia Phillips talks about what employers are looking for.
As an employer, we're looking for a certain personality type, and the mentality, there's certain mentalities that are not conducive to make an employer want to hire or sustain your employment. And I think we can have 70 million meetings if we're not addressing those behaviors that are rooted in interesting perspectives, then it's not going to go anywhere. It's like having a great lesson plan, but you haven't caught the student's attention. So you have to catch their attention by explaining to people, it doesn't matter if this is how you were raised, this is what the employer is looking for.
For more information on the Black Workers Center, visit www.1dconline.org/Black Workers Center. For On the Ground, this is Chantal James signing off.
And also for more information about the Apprentice Shift Program or the Mural Project at the Black Workers Center, you can also reach out to 1DC at organizer@1dconline.org. Now, as the bulk of D.C.'s 50,000 public school students prepare to return to the classroom on Monday, the Washington Teachers Union continues to call on teachers and parents to not buy school supplies at Walmart because of the push by the Walton family to privatize public schools and for Walmart's poor labor practices. WTU President Elizabeth Davis told On the Ground last week that D.C. teachers will spend hundreds of dollars of their own money to supply their students.
We don't believe that our teachers should patronize a company like Walmart that exploits its own workers and undermines public school employees. So, and I think that our teachers and parents will begin to understand that. I haven't shopped at a Walmart store in over 10 years for that very reason, because of their reputation, not only nationally, their global reputation.
The lessons taught in the coming school year may include those on the climate, as the DMV is one of the areas impacted by a so-called heat dome with some of the hottest temperatures on record, as much of Baton Rouge, Louisiana is submerged beneath floodwaters in the nation's worst natural disaster since Hurricane Sandy, and as 80,000 people have been evacuated in Southern California due to wildfires. In other planet news, divers from the climate justice organization 350.org temporarily placed crime scene tape near destroyed coral reefs in locations around the globe to draw attention to the role of the fossil fuel industry in the acidification and death of the world's oceans. Locally, activists continue to fight the construction of an export terminal for fracked gas in a densely populated area of Cove Point, Maryland, and are urging Governor Larry Hogan to order an independent safety study for the Cove Port export facility. Lots in culture and media this week. Some of the top moments from Rio: Simone Biles winning triple gold in gymnastics and Simone Manuel winning gold in swimming, and U.S. women sweeping the 200-meter hurdles. Some of the low points: those continued ignorant comments about Gabby Douglas's hair and other things that receive worthy rebuttals online as well. Now, controversy still swirls around Nate Parker, director of the eagerly anticipated and soon-to-be-released biopic on Nat Turner, Birth of a Nation, after reports that he was charged and acquitted of rape charges while he was a student at Penn State, and then allegedly engaged in harassment of the alleged victim who committed suicide 4 years ago. The controversy has created an outpouring of commentary from Black women and men about race and gender identity and sexual violence. Maisha Kai wrote on The Root, "It's frustrating and disappointing that once again we, those of us who love blackness and black men and who recognize the ongoing and desperate need for black stories like Nat Turner's, are forced to reconcile great art with the alleged dysfunction of its creator." And in movies news closer to home, the D.C. African Diaspora International Film Festival runs today, August 19th through Sunday, August 21st, at the George Washington University Marvin Center. 18 films will be shown, including 12 U.S. and D.C. premieres that will take audiences from the U.S. to Jamaica to Spain to Nigeria and Brazil and beyond. Tonight's opening and reception features two movies, the documentary Bad Sonia Sanchez, with a special live appearance by Sonia Sanchez and also co-director Sabrina Gordon. And also Kasim Basir will also be on hand to present his latest drama, Destined, about a 13-year-old boy with two possible outcomes in his life. Now joining me to talk about this year's festival is the co-founder and co-director Diarra Ndaw Speck. Good morning, Diarra.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Okay. I think that we may have lost her, but the festival is very diverse. And in addition to Bad Sonia Sanchez and Destined, there will be a program of movies about resistance in the Caribbean, about the spiritual practice of Santeria and Candomblé, movies from Switzerland, and also a documentary about a doctor who is treating women who have been, you know, raped and sexually tortured in the Congo. That's an issue that we've certainly talked about on our show and on different shows that we've worked on the station. And so there's a wide variety of films there. Is Diarra with us now?
Can you hear me? I'm here.
Okay, great. Good morning, Diarra.
Oh, good morning. How are you?
Oh, great. So, you know, it's good to talk to you again. I feel like I've actually been with you as your festival has grown through the years. And this is actually your 10th year in D.C., right?
Yes, it's our 10th anniversary. And we are very happy to have the lineup, as you described it, and the special guests, a lot of special guests coming this year.
Now, one of the films that I guess touches close to the contemporary experience here in the U.S. is Stand Down Soldier by Gerald Prescott Sales. And it's about an African-American female soldier that comes back to civilian life after serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. Tell us about that film and why you selected it.
Yeah, you know, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Cool. You were talking earlier about the ignorant comments that are being made about Gabby Douglas and all of the wonderful athletes, African-American
yes.
athletes.
Yes.
And I think it's important to show this film because Stand Down Soldier is maybe the first film that looks at the life of after the military from a black woman's perspective. And it is not an ignorant film. It's a very interesting film that looks at the trauma that this woman faces. After she comes back home, she saw some of her friends being killed during the war. She was subjected to sexual abuse. And when she comes back, she needs a structure to help her recover and reconnect with her family. She has become a new person. This film is very revealing. It was based on actually true stories by the filmmaker who was talking to family members and psychologists and really trying to understand what a military woman and a black woman has to go through, you know, the strength that she has to find within and also the support she has to find around her in order to be able to reestablish the normal life in her community. And I think this is a very important factor that people don't understand, and this film gives you an opening in understanding this reality, and it's a very important film for that reason.
So this year's festival, it's going to be at the George Washington University Marvin Center. It's a new location for you, and that's going to be tonight through Sunday. And again, that's the George Washington University Marvin Center, the African Diaspora International Film Festival, D.C.
There's a website where people can get all the details about the festival. That website is nyadiff.org. FF, that's for Film Festival, NYADIFF.org. And there they can see the film descriptions, they can see the trailers, they can purchase tickets. And we have, like you mentioned, Resistance in the Caribbean program, which is a program about films from Haiti, from Cuba, and Jamaica. We have a lot of filmmakers coming out, and we have a lot of strong films by and about women. And so I think there's a little bit of everything for everyone, and people should really check it out.
Thank you, Diarra. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
This morning, and I hope to be able to catch some of the festival this weekend.
I hope so, too.
Okay. Well, those are headlines and happenings. When we come back, tomorrow's town hall meeting against police murders and mass incarceration. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam. Well, we know the names Michael Brown, Alton Sterling, Sandra Bland, Ayanna Stanley-Jones. These are among the dozens of names listed in the announcement for the town hall meeting against police murders and mass incarceration happening tomorrow, Saturday, August 20th, 2 p.m. at the Gethsemane Baptist Church, 5119 4th Street in Northwest D.C. With me today is a core organizer and human rights attorney, Thomas Ruffin. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Esther.
Welcome to On the Ground. Well, let's start with your vision for the town hall. You know, why a town hall, and what do you want to accomplish tomorrow?
What we want to do with the town hall meeting against police murders and mass incarceration is this. With all of the powerful, truly inspired groups that are out here working to fight against this police state terror and 2 million people being locked up in America, what we are failing to do is to come together. In many respects, with all the successes that we're having, we're making a couple of mistakes that were made about 30 years ago, and that is, without even intending it, we're kind of in competition with each other. The enemy, the police state, whether it's Democrats, Republicans, the judges, the prosecutors, state officials, federal officials, municipal officials, they come together. If they hate each other, they come together. They don't part company when it comes to maintaining the power and the sovereignty of the police state. With us caught up in the terror we're facing and the need to organize with, actively coordinate with each other. So this town hall, the hope that a number of groups and plan their boycotts, their demonstrations, their traditional demonstrations and their radical, highly disruptive demonstrations and other activities, their press conferences and their social media educational formats, and do it with the aim towards freeing political prisoners, ending federal and state mass incarceration, and indeed stopping, setting up a plan, an effective plan for public policy to. And so what we want to do in that regard is, for example, have enough pressure for Congress, federally wise, and Maryland General Assembly for the state government to set standards that are firmly opposed such that police are highly dissuaded from killing us. Like when the cop who killed Paul O'Neill, his camera wasn't working. That should be an automatic basis for getting fired.
Well, I want to stop you right there. For example, firing, because I just read about the Chicago police superintendent officers who seem like they lied in the Laquan McDonald case. They basically fabricated their stories, had their stories to fit a narrative that didn't turn out to be true. So, but is firing good enough to, you know, if I commit a crime, I get arrested. You know, I get charged.
I'm not arguing against what you're standing for, Esther. What I'm saying is what you and I are sick of. Cops, like with regard to Laquan McDonald, they literally thought, even though they were confident somebody's equipment would videotape that murder, that they could lie on the murder, right, get the store cameras and destroy them. They actually did that. And if necessary, lie to investigating officers, lie to district attorneys, lie to assistant U.S. attorneys and get away with it. That's what they expected. And you've just made the point. The worst that they're facing is the prospect of getting fired. None of them have been indicted. And you can look at the videotape.
The officer who shot him.
He's actually been indicted? I didn't know that. Let's assume he's been indicted and charged with first degree murder. That would be unbelievable. But what about the cover up attending thereto? Right. What about all the cops who lied on it? What about the cops who were right there and failed to pull out their gun and arrest that fool? Right. We don't have that. And what I'm trying to say is, in order for that to happen, we just can't have this outstanding demonstration of outrage that's persisting with the Black Lives Matter campaign. That's not enough. And the older people can't say, I salute that, but I'd like for them to do it my way, or I'd like to know when you do it. They literally have to either join it or build up collaborative efforts on their own right, in their own wise.
And that's the idea.
And then to coordinate it so that we don't let what happened in Maryland General Assembly happen, and that is have a lot of that public policy not only be inspired by us lobbying for it and pressing for it, but in the end, they still wrote in, that is the Maryland General Assembly and the police state, wrote in what they wanted to be the public policy. And in Congress, Senator Grassley of Iowa, having to compromise with Senator Booker of New Jersey, they and others have come up with a compromise, a more or less a Democrat-Republican compromise in the Senate that won't be adopted this year. It might never be adopted. But if something's going to be adopted without our pressing for it, it'll more likely be that or something less. That's not adequate. We have to literally be there imposing the standards, and we have to figure out how to do that effectively. And we're not there yet. And with the vigor that we have with these variegated groups pressing for change, we can't waste that, because these folk will tire. They'll get older. We've seen it before. We'll see it again. And that's what the police state is waiting on, for us to tire, for us to get exhausted, for the audience out there, the broad audience, to say, well, that's been addressed, hasn't it? Or I'm tired of this issue. They'll wait us out unless we are effective in coming together. And so that's the main idea, for us to come together and coordinate for the next 6 to 12 months, coordinated campaigns against Congress and this president and the next one, and also to some degree the Council of the District of Columbia and the mayor and the Maryland General Assembly, for effective change along the lines that I'm talking about.
Okay. Well, I can see that for this town hall tomorrow, you're expecting something a little different than what we've seen in the many gatherings that have occurred since the murder of Trayvon Martin and the murder of Michael Brown 2 years ago. We've had a number of meetings right here in D.C. and gatherings and demonstrations that really where people were able to basically express their emotion, their sorrow, their despair, their outrage, really, at these continued police murders. One more thing before I have to go to the next segment, but you're making a conscious choice to link this issue of police murder to mass incarceration. Can you talk a little bit about your involvement in that issue and why it's important to link those?
Fundamentally, particularly when we look at the politics of the situation, there's no difference from the police state gunning down Tamir Rice, choking to death Eric Garner, or killing anybody else in the street in this videotape, and we see him say, wow, what a horrible incident. That's just murder. Something ought to be done. There's no fundamental difference from that from 2 million people being locked up in prison and 1 million of those people being black men. There's no way in the world we commit that much crime. And there's no way in the world that with so much of the prosecutions being about nonviolent offenses, some of which are questionably proven, that there should be that many people in prison.
Okay.
And so if we don't address the whole substance of what the police state is doing, that is the mass incarceration as well as this legalized lynching in the street, we're not addressing the problem. So to be effective, I think, just as the Black Lives Matter campaign have been doing, link the two, don't get lost with the outrageous kill. For example, when they're talking about Paul O'Neill, he's being handcuffed and he's dying while he's laying on the back. He was shot in the back. He's lying face down. And they said, didn't he shoot back? He never shot anything.
Right.
And so that will charge us up. But had he not been killed, he might have been locked away and put away for an exceedingly long period of time. And that might be an outrage in and of itself.
Okay. Well, I've been speaking with Thomas Ruffin, human rights attorney, about the town hall meeting against police murders and mass incarceration happening tomorrow, Saturday, August 20th, 2 p.m. at the Gethsemane Baptist Church, 5119 4th Street in Northwest D.C., here in the nation's capital. I do believe that you have a website for
townhallforjustice.org.
Right.
www.townhallforjustice.org. Okay. Please go there. There's a questionnaire on top of it, but it definitely allows people to see where the event's taking place.
Okay.
And what time. Please, and also, you alluded to it, Esther. We're not going to have Martin Luther King, I Have a Dream speeches. We're not going to have Malcolm X, Ballot of Bullets speeches.
Right. We
want the masses to plan on what we're going to do for 6 to 12 months.
Okay. Well, Thomas, I plan on seeing you there at the church. Thank you for joining me today. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Now, we'll be right back with Robin Kelly.
Out
Welcome back to On the Ground, onthegroundshow.org, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital. I'm Esther Averam. Well, regular listeners to On the Ground know that before it became a media buzzword for the Trump campaign, this show started a once-a-month segment in January 2015 called The F-Word for this weekly show exploring fascism, pre-fascism, and fascist trends in the United States. And my touchstone for this segment has remained George Jackson's definition that fascism is the complete control of the state by monopoly capital. So the segment has covered, for example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, privatization of so many government functions, private prisons, corporate influence over Washington, our elections, and destruction of our environment. But concurrent with the aftermath of Ferguson, discussions have also covered police brutality and continued extrajudicial murders of black people. Joining me today for this month's installment of the F-Word is Robin Kelly, professor and Gary B. Nash Endowed Chair in U.S. History at UCLA, author of several books, including Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination, Thelonious Monk, The Life and Times of an American Original, and most recently, Africa Speaks, America Answers, Modern Jazz in Revolutionary Times. Good morning, Robin.
Good morning, Esther. How are you doing?
Okay, welcome to On the Ground. Thanks for joining me so early from Los Angeles. So I'll jump right in. Let's start with your overview on this particular period. I have to say that opening the show, I actually played a clip from you speaking, I think, at UCLA, and where you were talking about that we're dealing with genocide. Mm-hmm. So I want to add it as a preface. And so it's your overview that covers this period where we're looking at this corporatization of so much of society and our increasingly, you know, ritualized and recorded murders.
Right, right. Yeah, these are strange times, and I sort of have two views of this. One is that on the one hand, you know, this continued looping of black people being killed by the police on social media from Eric Garner, Mike Brown on up, that plus the landscape of neoliberal policies, of free trade policies, of finance capital, just controlling every sphere of life, including healthcare and elections, and then the rise of Donald Trump. All this together makes it seem as though we're at a new moment, like a break. And it's caused a lot of panic. But what I worry about is so much of the focus on the spectacle of Trump in relationship to anti-violence is that it ends up promoting what I think is a very dangerous narrative, a narrative of where the Democrats are the good guys, you know, and that the state in the form of the federal government are our friends, you know, that the Justice Department could put out this blistering critique of the Baltimore Police Department, for example, or that Hillary Clinton can stand on the podium with the mothers of the victims of police violence. Meanwhile, mass incarceration still expands. The Obama administration still authorizes military hardware to fight the war on drugs. And despite all the talk about ending private prisons and this sort of thing. So my concern is that if we see this conjuncture as a new break, we end up missing the fact that we've been in this conjuncture for like the last 40 years, at least. On the one hand, I think there is a break. There's something different. But that difference, the moment that we're in, this moment of corporatization and state violence, the spectacle of state violence, I think has to do with resistance, that we're in a pivotal moment when some 50 or 60 organizations under the banner of the Movement for Black Lives, for example, or what was left of the Occupy movement, or, you know, other kinds of social justice movements have really ramped up these issues and issues and policies that they've been fighting since the 1970s. We've been fighting since the 1970s. I mean, even the issue of racialized state violence, you know, you and I both know, I mean, we came up the same time, that for our generation, there are certain names. Our generation, it wasn't Mike Brown, it was Eleanor Bumpers, it was Michael Stewart, it was Ulamae Love, it was Arthur McDuffie. We had the Liberty City Uprising in Florida in 1981. You had, you know, tens of thousands out in the street for Amadou Diallo and Oscar Grant, Patrick Dorsman. These are the names for our generation. So what I think what's different is not to say that there wasn't resistance then. There's always been resistance and ebbs and flows. But I think there's something different about the fact that the contradictions have sharpened to a great degree. And I'm not saying that I'm optimistic, but what I see is a continuation of struggle, a revelation of struggle that we haven't seen in a long time. And just one last thing about this, because I thought a lot about your question. And, you know, one of the things I find striking is that we're dealing with a group of young people, my daughter's generation, that refuses the false prophet of liberalism. You know, this is a generation that's unique in that they grew up with permanent war. They you know, America has been at war permanently for the last 12, 13 years, if not more, and not just wars abroad, but they were raised under drone strikes and drug wars. They were raised as kids watching internal refugees produced by the policies that produced Katrina. They were babies during the LA Rebellion and yet lived through the uprisings in Baltimore and Ferguson and saw mass murder in Charleston. This is the generation that saw the consequences of neoliberal policies in the mass poisoning and mass unemployment in Flint, Michigan. And it's one that, you know, lived under this regime of mass incarceration. But what's different, I think, is that they have come to not accept like 2.5 million people in prison and 7 million people under some kind of penal system as normative. You know, this is the generation that's probably the most abolitionist, the generation that sees caging people as inhuman, more so than not.
So we, like I mentioned, we played that clip at the opener for the show where you were, you know, talking about genocide. And I think policymakers, people who revolve around D.C. are generally afraid to use that term. Mm-hmm. But recently in D.C., there was a community meeting actually broadcast on this Pacifica station titled We Charge Genocide about the Flint crisis. And it just made me wonder, you know, how Black people can transcend the rhetoric of respectability and gradualism and address the fact and look at the issue of genocide and are being slaughtered.
Right, right. That's an excellent question. In part because the very people who get dismissed as a respectable
I think
policy,
you're kind of, you're, you're kind of going in and out a little bit. I don't know if you change any setting, but go back to the way it was before.
I didn't change anything. Didn't touch anything.
Oh, okay. Okay. Go ahead.
I'm still echoing.
What we may do is call us at the studio line, maybe at 202-588-0893, and we'll bring you back on. Okay. I think we have you back again, Robin.
Yes. And I'll send you a check for $300.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, no, I'm not kidding. Okay, so let me pick up where I left off, which is, you know, Dr. King, in March of 1968, had defined genocide. He says racism is based on an ontological affirmation. It is the notion that the very being of a pure people is inferior. And the ultimate logic of racism is genocide. I mean, it's not... The only way we were able to run away, the only possible way they made genocide a word that was unacceptable to liberals was through constant pressure. And genocide actually, according to the, you know, second article of the Geneva Convention or the UN Resolution on Genocide, it's very clear that what we're seeing in terms of mass incarceration, what we're seeing in terms of cultural genocide, what we're seeing in terms of not just everyday state violence, but the violence of mass unemployment, the violence of health disparities, that these things do represent genocide. The term recharge genocide, as you know, go back to Paul Robeson and William L. Patterson's document in 1951, where they basically approached the United Nations and said, you know, what we're witnessing in Black America is a form of genocide. It's a term that we actually have to embrace. You can't run away from it anymore because it does speak to our condition, which is the condition of being vulnerable to premature death. That's what we're facing. And part of my worry is that if we reduce what is clearly policies of genocide simply to the every single day someone gets shot by publicly financed bullets, that's the limitation of genocide, then we miss all the people who are experiencing everyday forms of not just social death but physical death through these policies.
Okay. So I know this, I wanted to have more time for us. We could talk so much more, but I've kind of run out of time, but we'll have to have you back. I've been speaking with Robin Kelly, author, historian. Everyone knows about your like many books and stuff. I already said all that, but thank you so much for joining me this morning on the Ground.
Yeah. And send me an address to send that check.
Okay.
And good luck.
All right. Thank you. And that will do it for us on the Ground, onthegroundshow.org. Thanks to our guests today, Professor Robin Kelly, Thomas Ruffin, Tracy Redd of BYP 100, and also Chantel James for all of her help, and our engineer, Mike Nasella, as well. And thank you for listening. Please don't forget to like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. I'm Esther Avaram. Raise your voice out there. Peace.
Sweet time. I'll give it right back to you. But one of these days.